All right, my name is Don Hall, and I haven't met with this group yet, but glad to have you here. My portion of this training is, the first one was kind of on the theory and the philosophy of Adventist health ministry, and then we talked about methods and health coaching and how to work with people one-on-one and so on, and how to help people make lifestyle changes. And then the last part is, what shall we teach them? And if you've got your notebooks, turn to that section where it says Health Knowledge 1. And I'd like to just kind of go over some of the things that's there a little bit to reinforce what we're about. And it says, and we'll just read a little bit those first few lines. It says, all health ministry leaders need a good understanding of the essentials for good health. Does that make good sense? And we want to make sure that we're all on the same base and we're teaching the things that are best and most important for people to know. It says, there are lots of ideas expressed by many peoples, but what are the essential elements that are required for good health? And sometimes there's a lot of little side issues, but what we want to talk about are the priorities. Secondly, it says, what is the basis upon which we base health knowledge? It's important that all health programs be sponsored by our churches be based on solid information. Make good sense again? You see, when people come to hear our message, we want to have good spiritual truth, don't we? And we base that on the Bible. So when we're talking about healthful living, what do we base that on? Well, down in the next paragraph, we'll get into that. So the Adventist Church is committed to truth and spiritual doctrines based on the Bible, but the health information we provide through our church programs must also be committed to accurate and reliable content if we expect to build what? Credibility and trust. And that's important. So if we have information that we're giving that's not really accurate, and we have knowledgeable people there and so on, they'll say, well, that's kind of a flaky program. I'm not sure I want to be associated with that church. Their Bible teachings may be kind of flaky too. You see how that works? And so it's important that we have good information there. So down to the third paragraph then. It says, this section of the NAD Health Ministry Leadership Training focuses on the key factors of healthful living that should form the basis of what is taught. And we can't cover everything that's here, but we're going to try to give kind of an introduction, cover as much of it as we can. And there's a term that we used when we're talking about health information. It's called evidence-based. Are you familiar with that term? Some we use in medicine a lot, that we want our information to be evidence-based. In other words, it's based not just on someone's theory or someone's thought, but we have good, sound research, and here's what they did, and here's what they found, and these are things we know that will make a difference in that person's life to keep them healthier. So those are some of the things we're trying to emphasize. It also points out there that health information changes occasionally. Have you noticed that? And so we want to update this periodically. And we're going to our goal is to put this on the website. It's going to take a few months to get it there. But any time that you want to go back and review some of these sections and so on, you'll have that information you can. When new research comes out, we'll update that and include it. So try to keep the latest information you can so that it's both reliable and evidence-based information. Now, if you just turn that page over, there's a little bit of an outline. And that was all what I'm supposed to cover, but there simply isn't enough hours to do that. But I do have presentations on all of those topics, so you will find those in there. All of them that I was responsible for, I think there's one or two that aren't there. The one on the mental emotional health isn't, but we will get that on the web so that you'll have access to that too. And we hope that Katya will be able to come and share some of that this afternoon. Then if you turn the page once more, that'll kind of give you a bit of an idea of what that will be like. And one of the things we're finding that's important for good health is sleep. Did you know that if you don't get adequate sleep, you will actually die sooner? And if you want to live a long, full life, choosing to get adequate rest is important. So there'll be a little brief introduction, and then there'll be a presentation that you can look at. And those are the same presentations that we're talking about here. We're going to put them on the internet, and we're going to put a few more words with it so that you can get the idea of what's being presented, and that topic will be there. And it'll be maybe 10 or 15 minutes. You can view it on the web and see what it's there. There may be a handout, usually, that will go with that. And then eventually at the bottom, there's some additional study resources. So if you want to learn more about sleep, you'll notice here there's a 4-page Getting Adequate Sleep and Rest. And there will be a link to that. And being this will all be on the internet, you just click there and those will pop up. And then if you want to go further, the National Institutes of Health, the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, has a section on sleep. Did you know sleep is important for your heart? And if you don't get good sleep, it can cause heart problems. And that's why the heart group is interested in that. And they have a very nice four-page handout on that. And then if you want to know more, here's the National Institutes of Health information on sleep. There's 21 pages. And some of that material is in the back, and you can look through some of that. But this gives you an idea of what we're going to do. We'll have a brief slideshow that'll go over the key things. We'll have some handouts, and then there will be these references. So we want to have good, sound information in all of these important areas of topic. How can you tell what is really true? We have a presentation in here that deals with that. How do you evaluate information? And I hope we get a chance to get to it. If we don't, it's talking about it there. As a health professional, my background, by the way, is I have a doctor's degree in preventive health care. And so that helps. You can go to school for many years, and they give you a lot of good, basic, sound information. And it gives you more information on which to judge things with. But in the scientific world, we like to look at research that's been published in what we call peer-reviewed journals, and where they do studies, and usually it's large numbers of people, and you'll see as I get into this, usually it's 10, 20, 30,000 people, sometimes it's 500,000 people. And they may study them for 5 or 10 years, and they look and try to observe what are the health practices that make a difference, that cause increased risk of heart attack or cancer or whatever. And those are the things we look for, and things that people say, well, I drank, you know, this green tea or whatever, and it cured my liver cancer. Well, that's a personal experience, and it's interesting, but not necessarily reliable evidence, is it? So we'll look at some of those kinds of things on making sure. The CHS is Certified Health Education Specialist. There's a certification for that. So anyway, I've spent my life working on health. And it's been fun. We have a company called WellSource, and we work with corporations across North America. And why do you suppose companies are interested in keeping their employees healthy? It does. It costs less. Plus the fact that if they're not sick, they're on the job and they're productive, right? And it was like a call I got from the president of one of the large electronic firms in Portland recently, Intel Corporation. And they said, we'd like you to come talk to all of our administrative staff. We feel they're key individuals. We just lost one from a heart attack. It's been a serious blow to our company. We want to make sure they're healthy, and they contribute a lot to the future of this company. And we just want to invest in their health. Makes good sense, doesn't it? Well, how about us? Shouldn't we be investing in our health as well? And so we want to take some of those same principles we've used in the corporate setting. And we work with about 700 organizations nationwide right now, and about 300 hospitals and large institutions, a lot of universities and so on. And we're trying to take some of those same principles we use in the corporate setting and simplify them so that we can use them in our church setting. All right. Any questions before we jump in? Any more questions? We don't have that up yet. This will actually be, I'm preparing it, but it'll actually be on the North American Division website. And then that's the first step, because we want to have training for the leaders. The second step might be you might like to use some of this information yourself in making presentations at your church or something. And I'll be preparing those, and we'll have that all on a CD, or we'll also have it on our website, so you can use it either way.
Your website or
NAD? Be on my website. But that's coming down the road just a little bit. This is our first presentation, and so it's a pilot project. And as soon as we get all the bugs worked out, then we want to have these resources for you to use.
So the PowerPoints here are not going
to be on the NAD? Yes, they will be in a format for your use as training, but they won't be for the general population. In other words, it's a church health ministry training website.
And what is your website?
Well, I've got a few, but it'll be under what's called Lifelong Health. And that's not available yet. I'm just letting you know that that's coming. That's our plans. We're working as fast as my little wheels will pedal. I'm just volunteering my time. And I have to run this other company too, but we're getting it up there. All right, so let's jump in. And the first one I'm going to just show a few slides from. We want to talk about priorities and the kinds of things we can do in a church. Now, we're health ministry leaders. That means we're going to work through largely educational efforts, isn't it? We are not healthcare providers, and that's important to know. We don't treat disease. We don't try to diagnose disease. If people have specific problems, they need to see their doctor or other healthcare providers and get that professional treatment. But we can teach people how to live healthfully and particularly how to prevent disease and by living healthfully. And so that's what we're going to emphasize here. And then what are the key things we need to emphasize in helping people to be healthy? So prevention. It's always better to prevent disease than to cure it. Would you agree with that? And so if we get sick, we do need medical care. We should get it. But there's a lot of things we can do to live healthfully to keep us from having to get those problems. And that's what we're going to look at. Now, here's a slide that came from a medical journal that talks about what are the preventable causes of death. And what we really got this slide up for here is how do we set priorities? What are the leading causes of preventable death? What are people dying from that they might be able to do differently that will save their life? And let's just look at this. What's the number one cause? Smoking. 467,000 people dying each year from the effects of cigarette smoking. Pretty major problem, isn't it? So we always want to keep that focus. And I'm thankful I was born in a church where we didn't smoke. I don't have to deal with that. My parents raised me as a non-smoker. But it's still an important issue, isn't it? And people who join our church, people in our community are dealing with this, struggling with this. We need to be able to help those people. Number two, if you're a non-smoker, what is the second thing you're most likely to die from? High blood pressure. Is that a bit of a surprise? It's our most common health problem in the United States, isn't it? About one out of every three people. And we'll get into that in a minute. Obesity, is that a very big problem? That's probably our most common one, isn't it? About two-thirds of the people are either overweight or excessively overweight, or called obese. But notice there, over 200,000 people a year dying prematurely that if they had their weight under control, they wouldn't. It's quite amazing, isn't it? So that's one of the underlying issues that we want to work with in our churches and our communities. Notice the next one there, just about the same. Inactivity or low amounts of exercise. Again, almost 200,000 people. Now, how about in our churches? Do you suppose our church members are any more fit than the population as a whole? Probably not. And so that's a key factor of things that we can work with them and keeping them to be healthier. The next one that's listed here is high blood sugar. And if the blood sugar gets too high, what does it cause? Diabetes, doesn't it? And they're saying that the blood sugar levels of our nation could be brought down by healthier living, and 190,000 people a year could be, deaths could be prevented by lowering blood pressure. You don't have to have diabetes to suffer the effects, health effects of high blood sugar. Did you know that? And so even long before you get diabetes, people with pre-diabetes, elevated blood sugar but not high enough to be called diabetes yet or do actual medication and treatment and insulin and so on, but they have health risks. And you can live in such a way as to lower those blood sugar levels and lower those risks. So we have a whole program. That's what is completed out there. It's called Preventing Diabetes. And it talks about how to keep blood sugar levels low. Then high LDL cholesterol. What happens if our cholesterol gets too high? It tends to clog in the arteries, doesn't it? And cause heart disease. And we can go on down there. High dietary salt. We eat too much sodium, what's liable to happen? High blood pressure. And it also has, seems to be an independent damaging effect to the heart, even outside of blood pressure. So notice that over 100,000 people a year, if they simply didn't use as much salt, they could prevent that from perhaps from dying. A low omega-3 fatty acids. Have you thought about that? We're finding that those omega-3 fatty acids have special properties that seem to be helpful. One is to the brain, and we're finding that in preventing Alzheimer's, perhaps, and depression, that those kinds of elements are important. And also for the health of the heart. And notice there, 84,000 people a year. They simply got more omega-3 fatty acids. Well, where do you find those? Well, we'll talk about that when we're talking about healthy fats. High trans fats, that's an unhealthy fat, isn't it? Nearly as many people are dying from that. And when we have a high intake of trans fats, that's especially damaging to the heart. It increases the risk for diabetes. It increases the risk for breast cancer. There's a whole bunch of things that can have an effect. So we need to cut that out as much as possible. And then alcohol use. 64,000 people die each year from alcohol use. Now, actually, that is closer to about 90,000, but they've reduced that just a little bit because older people who use alcohol on a moderate basis have fewer heart attacks. It's just a fact. We don't like to admit that sometimes. And so they've subtracted 30,000 lives from that. Otherwise, it would be closer up there towards 100,000. We're not recommending that as a therapy for healthy hearts, but it is a fact that's there. And then the next one, low intake of fruits and vegetables. Just about as many people who's dying from heart or from alcohol just from not eating enough fruits and vegetables. Isn't that interesting? And then the last one down there is just, again, the PUFA. What is PUFA? Well, that's polyunsaturated fatty acids. That's the vegetable fat. That's the kind, the oils, that's the kind of fats that's found in the plant kingdom. And we find that if people ate a little more of those, in that case, it says you would save over 15,000 lives a year if they simply upped their intake a little bit of the PUFAs in their diet. Isn't that interesting? But we'll look at all of that. Anyway, it gives us some perspective, doesn't it? And so those are kind of things that help us to focus. What can we do with the groups we're working with that can really save lives? And that's what that program shows. Now, I think I'm going to just bounce right out of this program, and we're going to get into specifics. We're going to get back on the first one there. It's in your book. It's on nutrition. So I'm going to hit the escape here, and we'll minimize that one and maximize this one. Now, there's a lot of cover to go, so I'm going to go pretty quick. And if we have questions that are just burning, you can't stand it, we'll answer them. If not, we'll try to take them at the end of the section, and it might make it a little easier for us to zip along, okay? Now, the first one. We don't often think about in the importance of the kind of carbohydrates we're eating. But the kind of carbohydrates we eat are just as important as the kind of fats. We hear a lot about that, don't we? Saturated fat and cholesterol and so on. But we're finding there's healthy and unhealthy carbohydrates. And in the old days, we used to call them complex and simple carbohydrates. You can see how they were listed there. And they said the complex ones were good and the simple ones were bad. Did you hear that? That was kind of what was taught. Do you want to throw that idea out? That's an old idea. It's not valid anymore. And we find there's a better way to classify things because you'll notice the fruits down there are with the simple sugars, aren't they? And those fruits are healthy. And the starches are up there with the complex carbohydrate, but we find starches like the white bread there can be just as detrimental to our health as high sugar intake. So we have a better term, should be unrefined carbohydrates. Well, the word doesn't show there, but it's supposed to. Okay, so some unrefined, these are the ones we should be using more of. They're the whole grains, aren't they? You can see them listed there. And other unrefined ones would be things like steamed squash and beets and the red potatoes. Red potatoes have a little healthier for us than the regular baked potato and so on. All vegetables are unrefined. They're very excellent. And the fruits. And so those are the ones we need to be eating more of. Then we have the refined carbohydrates. Notice the white breads, and the rolls, the pancakes, the cookies, pastries, and all those kinds of things. They're made out of grains, but they're refined, and so they're not as healthy for us, are they? Potato chips and fries would be another example. And then all the different kinds of sugars and sweets. Soft drinks, that's the number one source of calories for a lot of people in this modern world. And you can look on down through, and desserts. Any of you like desserts? I think we all like desserts, don't we? We just make sure we get as healthy ones as we can and keep the other kind to a minimum. So what's the effect on the health? Well, the refined carbohydrates, they're low in fiber, they're low in nutrients, they're high in glycemic index. Are you familiar with that term? That is a measure of how fast the blood sugar rises in your blood after you eat them. And some foods make your blood sugar rise rapidly, and that's not good for us, we're finding out. And they're linked to increased risk of chronic disease. And we'll look at those. The unrefined carbohydrates, on the other hand, they're high in fiber, which we're finding is protective. They're high in the nutrients that the body requires for good health. They raise the blood sugar levels lower, so we say they're lower glycemic index. and they're protective foods. So we want to eat less of these and more of these, don't we? We need to shift in that direction. And this just shows a little example. This is an actual person's blood sugar levels and what they did. And when we look in here, we're going to look at two kinds of foods. First of all, white bread, the solid line. And this zero doesn't mean their blood sugar level is zero. It means what it was when they woke up in the morning. That's the baseline. If your blood sugar level gets to zero, you're in trouble, aren't you? You can't live that level. The brain quits functioning. It has to have a certain amount. So that's just baseline. And then they give the person different foods, and white bread is often used as a standard now. And they eat white bread, and it's absorbed very rapidly. And notice how fast it goes up. This is your blood sugar level. So when the blood sugar level goes up very quickly, and we look down here, about in the first hour it goes up to the highest level, this chart is showing blood insulin levels. So when your sugar levels go up very quickly, the pancreas says, oh, lots of sugar coming. Got to produce lots of insulin, because insulin's what brings it down. And so then it produces a huge insulin spike here, because it kind of overreacts because it went up so fast, and then all of a sudden the blood sugar levels plummet and they go even lower than they were when you get up, when you got up that morning. And what is that now? That's about 2 hours later, isn't it? And now they go down into what's called hypoglycemia, or low. And how do you feel when your blood sugar is low? Not very good, do you? You might get trembly, you might get a headache, you get you're nervous and upset, anxiety levels are higher, brain doesn't work so well. All of those things are negative effects. So around about 10 o'clock, what do you see in the office or the workplace? I live not too far from a 7-Eleven store, and I look out my window about 10 o'clock. I see this parade of people going by, and they're going down to the 7-Eleven. And pretty soon here they come back, and what do they have? They have this great big thing called a Big Gulp. And what is it? Loaded with sugar. And oh, I don't know, it must be a whole quart of it. It's a huge amount of sugar. And so they get their blood sugar levels up again, but they go through this cycle, and they kind of go all day long. And when that blood sugar level is high up here and it drops very quickly, where's it going to go? It's got to go to storage, doesn't it? And this is what we call stored calories, stored energy, stored carbohydrates. And it goes into storage easily. It comes out more difficult, doesn't it? So we have to be careful of that. So what we're suggesting is if you eat a healthier food, it irons that out. Now, here's another one. This is called spaghetti. We've all had that. It's made out of exactly the same thing, almost, isn't it? But why does a spaghetti not absorb or raise the blood sugar levels so fast? Let's look at it right here. It goes up more gradually. Here's the insulin response. And so then it comes down more gradually. And here, about 3 or 4 hours later, it's still above what you were at breakfast time. So you have more satiety from that. So this is a low glycemic index food. Now, when it's made out of the same thing, it's still all wheat, isn't it? Why is it lower? Yeah, had to think about it for a while. Now, if you take a piece of white bread and you kind of crumble it up and put it in a glass of water, and you come back in about 2 minutes, where is it? It's just all disintegrated and all little pieces and so on. And so when you eat that white bread and it hits your stomach, it's digested very quick because it is in little small pieces that the digestive enzymes can get to it and it's absorbed very quickly. If you take spaghetti and leave it in water for 5 or 10 minutes, when you come back, what is it? Still spaghetti. It's in big chunks. And so it's the physical shape as well as the starch and so on itself. And when it goes down to the stomach, it's in these bigger chunks. It takes longer for it to break down, and then it's absorbed more slowly. You can do the same thing with oats. If you have quick oats that are smashed real thin, maybe even steamed a little bit and so on, they hit the stomach, they're absorbed very quickly. If you have old-fashioned oats, it's a little slower. If you have steel-cut oats, where they take the whole grain of the oat and just cut it in 2 or 3 pieces, it's in big chunks, and you eat that, it's the lowest. And so if you want a low glycemic breakfast, steel-cut oats would be a nice low one, the lowest of all the oats. By the way, if you eat Cheerios, is Cheerios 100% oats, whole grain? Yeah, it is. It's the whole oat, but it's ground up real fine, isn't it? So when you eat Cheerios, where do you suppose it is on there? It's even higher than white bread, even though it's a whole grain. Now, you do get a little fiber and things with it. So we need to know, we just need to be a little smarter in choosing some of these things, which are the best ones to use based on their glycemic index. We'll look at some of these here for just a moment. Now, what they usually normally use today now for doing these kinds of studies, they use white bread. They used to use glucose, but people didn't like drinking that sweet stuff. And so now they use bread. And then they compare other foods. So they give the white bread 100. That's the amount of the rise you get in your blood sugar. And everything else is relative to that. Notice what do you have here? Table sugar. Table sugar raises your blood sugar level even slower than white bread. Is that a surprise? Who would have thought? And so they used to put white bread in the complex carbohydrates because it was mostly starch. And now we see, well, just giving it that name doesn't mean it's healthy because it's actually absorbed more quickly than even table sugar. Let's look at some other favorites here in America. French fries. You like French fries? Is that a vegan food? Sometimes we think, well, it's just made out of vegetables. It's got to be good for us, right? But not very good for the blood sugar, is it? It goes up quickly. And what we find is that particularly potatoes, even though, again, it's a starch, it's absorbed very quickly when it hits the stomach and raises the blood sugar, again, even faster than table sugar. Here's mashed potatoes, even a little higher. And it's a little more small pieces, isn't it? French bread. You like that good, crusty French bread? I like the crusty bread, but I try to get the whole grain kind. Very high, isn't it? And then here's glucose. That's what the body uses. Hits the stomach and just goes right in. That's about the highest of any there is. Okay, so let's go down and look at some other ones. Here's some unrefined carbohydrates now. And by the way, anything that has a glycemic index that's less than 80, based on bread as the standard, would be considered a low glycemic food. So here's brown rice, 77. If we didn't get white rice up there, but it'd be just like this white bread or higher. So that's pretty good, isn't it? And it's got the fiber with it. It's also a little bigger chunk, and it doesn't dissolve quite so quickly, and so it has a low glycemic index. Here's the steel-cut oats, a little lower yet, isn't it? Here's an orange. Who would have thought an orange has a lower glycemic index than brown rice? And that's good, isn't it? So some of the simple carbohydrates, we used to put all the simple carbohydrates, don't eat too many of those, is actually good, and it has a lower glycemic index than even whole wheat bread. Don't have whole wheat bread on there, but it would be up around 85 or so on usually. Chickpeas, around about 60, isn't it? Look at the apple way down there. Lentils, down to 41. Look at the soybean, 26. Okay, so all of these foods, as it keeps your blood sugar level lower, it does two things. One is it keeps that insulin from going up quickly, and so you don't get that overreaction, which brings your blood sugar level down. You get hungry. And what do we want to do when we're hungry? We want to eat, don't we? So if you have something that's absorbed more slowly, it has more what we call satiety value. You don't get so hungry because your blood sugar levels are still higher, and it keeps you from eating so soon. And that then helps us what? Well, it helps us from overeating and helps to keep us from gaining weight. So that's one of the advantages. The second thing it does is when the blood sugar levels are high, they begin to damage our bodies. And they damage the red blood cells and the little arteries that go throughout the body to our heart and our eyes and our kidneys and so on. We call that glycation. Have you heard of glycated hemoglobin or hemoglobin A1C? That's a test that measures that glycation of the glucose molecule and the whatever it's attaching itself to, and it can do damage in the brain. So low glycemic foods are helpful in preventing both heart disease and stroke and kidney failure and diabetes and all those things that go with it. So here's one on glycemic index and risk of diabetes. And this is a large study to look down here. 91,000 people. Big study, isn't it? And it was a study that went, it doesn't say how many years, I usually put that in there, but I believe this is the Women's Health Study, so probably about a 10 to 14 year period. Now over here we have risk of getting diabetes. They looked at the people's diets, averaged out their glycemic index, and as we look over this range, as that goes up, what happens to the risk of getting diabetes? See, this is low glycemic index, and these are what we call quintiles. Let me just explain this, because this is something that's used a lot in research. The first quintile, that would be the 20% of the people who have the lowest of whatever you're looking at, okay? In this case, glycemic index. This is the next 20% who are higher, the next 20% who are higher, and so on, until this is the 20% of the people who have the highest. So we have from low to high, and when we go from low glycemic index to high glycemic index, what happens to our risk of developing diabetes? It goes up nearly 60%. That's a big increase, isn't it? So one way of keeping our risk of diabetes down, choosing unrefined carbohydrates. Okay? Now here again, we can look at cereal fiber. And we find that fiber is helpful. And fiber kind of slows the absorption of glucose again. And that's one good way of helping to keep our blood sugars lower, is eating more fiber. Now we see just the opposite. Again, 91,000 people, a very thorough study. And notice as the fiber goes up, what happens to the risk of diabetes? It goes down. So what we want to prevent diabetes is high fiber foods. That's again the unrefined carbohydrates. And we want low glycemic index. And they kind of go together, don't they? So both of those factors are showing by research that it's helpful. Here's another one showing this time on glycemic index or load of people and the risk of coronary heart disease. Here's the risk of heart disease. Here's the 20% of the people who have the lowest glycemic index foods. And as they begin to go up, what happens to the risk of heart disease? Large study, isn't it? 10-year study. Over 10 years, twice as many people who had the high glycemic foods developed heart disease as those who ate the low glycemic ones. So is it important? Yeah, we have good evidence today, evidence-based, that it's better for us to choose healthier, unrefined foods that keep our blood sugar levels lower. Who would have thought that the kind of carbohydrates we eat can double the risk of heart attacks? Interesting, isn't it? Now, if this was fat, and we'll show these a little later on, if you go from low to a high saturated fat intake, you know what that increases your risk of heart disease? These same people? How much?
Five.
Four or five times? That's what we might think. But it was actually only increased at 40 to 50%. So what does that mean? That means the kind of carbohydrate we eat may raise our risk of heart disease as much or more than even the kind of fat. We hear a lot about saturated fat. We don't hear a lot about refined carbohydrates, do we? So both are important. All right. Now, where do we find fiber? Well, it's very obvious. Fiber is in the whole grains and the fruits and the vegetables and those kinds of things, don't we? We can see some foods down here. But here's the refined ones. Most of the fiber has been taken out of the white bread, hasn't it? And the corn flakes and the donut and all those kinds of things, ice cream. Not much fiber in a soft drink, is there? And this is what most Americans are eating, are a lot of these kind of foods for their carbohydrates, aren't they? So no wonder they have problems. Now if we go down to the whole wheat bread, and here's corn on the cob maybe, be about equal to that. And shredded wheat, a good high fiber cereal, and how about an orange and so on. See how these are all loaded with fiber? And we eat those kinds of foods, is very protective against heart disease and all kinds of things. So here's this study where they took 388,000 people. That's a large study, isn't it? And it looked at the amount of fiber in their diet, and then over 9 years, they saw who developed specific diseases. And we're going to look at these specific diseases. Now, they divided people into two groups. Those in the blue represent here the low fiber intake and their risk of that disease. And I didn't put it beside each one just because there's several diseases. So we're comparing the low intake, low fiber intake to the high fiber intake. So those who eat more fiber, notice, does it make a difference in heart attacks and strokes, cardiovascular disease? It reduced it by about 25%, doesn't it? Those who eat more fiber had almost 20% less cancer. Those who had more fiber had 56% fewer infectious diseases. Isn't that interesting? Why would fiber protect against infectious diseases? Direct effect on the immune system. It appears that it does. One thing that it does is it reduces inflammation, which has to do with the immune system. May have some factors to do with high blood sugar, too. When your blood sugar levels are higher, what does that do to your immune system? It suppresses it. We know that diabetics who have high blood sugar, they're more likely to get infections, aren't they? So this was kind of a surprise. Eating the whole fiber foods, very protective against infectious diseases. And here's respiratory diseases. Interesting, isn't it? And all other diseases, a 30% decrease. So these are simple things, aren't they? We just choose the unrefined foods, we get more dietary fiber, healthier carbohydrates, and it affects almost every system of the body. So here's their summary. They said for every 10-gram increase in dietary fiber per day, the risk of death from any cause dropped by how much? 14% in men. And how much in women? Even more so in women, 17%. Now, if I could give you a pill, if you take it once a day, and it would cut your risk of dying from any cause by 14 to 17%, you think that'd be popular medication? You think I'd be a rich man soon? I'm sure I would. But here you can do it, and it's simple, and all we have to do is eat more high-fiber foods. And where do we find fiber? From whole plant foods. Whole plant foods, not unrefined. The kinds that God chose us to eat. And so we can look down through here. Fresh fruits, all different kinds. What's some of your favorite? Don't they look good in that little picture there? Especially as we're getting closer to lunch. For breakfast, I had strawberries and blueberries and an orange. And those are all good for us. They're high in fiber, they're healthy. And those are the kind of foods we need any more of. Or whole grains. Steel-cut oats, if you like. And when I'm home, that's one of my favorites. Or if you like shredded wheat. If you eat bread, get the whole wheat bread always. And when you buy bread, get the kind of bread that's in big chunks. You can buy bread that's that way. Some of it is finely ground. And it's just like almost the texture of white bread. But you get the kind that's in the big chunks. And what you'll find is that has a very low glycemic index. And that's the healthier kinds to be using. Lots of vegetables. Salads. All kinds of things. Tomatoes, squash, broccoli, greens. All of those. Very protected to the system. And the legumes. And by the way, of all the foods, legumes are the highest in fiber of any food. So, eating lots of legumes are excellent. And here's what you should be getting today, and that's a number you should be familiar with. Somebody asks, how much fiber should I eat? And here are the guidelines for Americans, at least 25 grams a day for women. And men tend to be a little bit bigger and eat a little more, about 38 grams of dietary fiber for men. Now, this is just showing that's not only the brown bread, whole grain bread, but it's also the rice, isn't it? And look at the comparison here. Here's on fiber. Here's the white rice. Here's the brown rice. Does it make a difference which one we eat? 2.6 times more fiber. 2.25 times more iron. 5.7 times more magnesium. 2.3 times more potassium. Almost twice as much zinc and folate. And look at the polyunsaturated fats. Those are the kind the body has to have for good health. Remember we looked on that list? Said there's 15,000 people dying a year from getting the healthy kind of fat. And the brown rice is 5 times higher in it. Isn't that interesting? So everything about the food, if we eat it more like God has made it, and eat it in the unrefined state, the healthier it'll be for us. Now, what kind of rice do you suppose most members in your church organization, local church use? Or any American community. About 80 to 90% of the people always choose white rice, don't they? I've been going to some of the restaurants around here, some Thai restaurants and things. I like Thai food. And I ask them, now, do you have brown rice? Just white rice. Well, so every time I go to a restaurant, I always chide them a little bit. I say, well, don't you know that brown rice is healthier for you? You should have that for your people here, too. And I've been doing that at home for years now. And now, all the places where I go to eat Thai food, if I ask for brown rice, they have it for me. So if we want something healthier, what do we need to do as a people? Yeah, if we don't ask for it, are they going to provide it? So we need to let people know. Do it in a nice way. Smile and be kind, but say, you know, brown rice is a lot more important and a lot better for your health. So here's just a quick summary. Choose primarily unrefined carbohydrates, high in fiber, low in glycemic index. Those are the healthiest kinds of carbohydrates. And remember, when we do that, you might cut your risk of a heart attack in half. And you can see them listed down there. Then the kind of foods we want to eat less of is over there in that far column, isn't it? The white breads and rolls, pancakes, cakes and cookies, all those kinds of things. That's where most of the white flour is used, isn't it? Refined breakfast cereals. You know you can find breakfast cereals that have more sugar in them than actually grain. If you read the label, you can tell because the first ingredient is listed first. A lot of them have sugar first. Less snacked foods, potatoes, chips and fries, soft drinks, candy, high sugar desserts, syrups, and all those kinds of things. That's the kind of carbohydrates that'll get us in trouble. And again, are those very common over there? That's mostly what you get, don't you? And so it's the same thing with pancakes and waffles and so on, too. Have you got a good recipe for a whole grain waffle? If you don't, I should have put one in here. We make those all the time at home. But you think of a waffle. It starts with white flour, got eggs in it. It's got some kind of fat usually. And then you bake it up, and then what do you put on top usually? Some kind of solid fat, a butter or something. And then you put sugar water all over the top of it. And we think that's supposed to be healthy for us. And it's a wonder we survive. But if you can start with a waffle that starts, the one I like to make, it's actually from the Oats, Peas, Beans, and Barley Cookbook. Have you ever seen that one? Some of you have seen that one. It's been around a long time, but it's good, whole, unrefined foods. And it starts with oats and sunflower seeds primarily. And they've got about 10 or 20 different variations you can do on that. You put it in the blender and you whiz it all up. And then we bake it. Takes it a little bit longer. And then we put fresh strawberries and blueberries. And I sprinkled some walnuts on top. You see, you can have a really delicious meal and be healthy for you at the same time, can't you? And it's high in fiber and it's high in protein and it's a low glycemic index and all of the good things it's good for us. So that's what we need to be encouraging in our health classes, in our communities, in our churches, moving more in those kind of directions and teaching people how to do that. Because most of our church members yet don't know how to do that. And that's what we need to do. Okay, any questions on healthy carbohydrates? Yes. What you'll find is the sweet potatoes are lower glycemic index than the white potatoes. Okay. And unfortunately, the good old baked potato that I grew up on raises your blood sugar just about as fast as anything you can eat. And the nurse's health study, they found that that was one of the foods. It was white bread, white rice, white potatoes, and soda pop. Those were the things that were most closely related to increasing the risk of diabetes. So sweet potatoes would be a little better. The yam would be the same as the sweet potato. I don't know what a manaka is. It's a root.
In Walmart, you see this shiny-looking brown thing?
Uh-huh.
That's the manaka. It's mostly eaten by the
Latinos. Yeah.
It's high in fiber than the Chinese.
That might be helpful. If you eat it in the natural state, it would probably be more helpful, too. And by the way, just because the potato is bad doesn't mean we should never eat them.
Okay.
I mean, they raise our blood sugar level. But let's not eat them so much. And let's not eat such great big giant ones. Maybe cut it in half and have it less often. And if you're going to use a potato, I think the little red ones, we find that they have a lower glycemic index than the big ones. So that would be better too. You had a comment? Yeah, the little red potatoes are the best ones. We like to get the little ones, cut them in half, bake them in our oven, and they're delicious. And so we eat those occasionally. What if you ate more fiber than that? You'd probably live even longer. These numbers that are up here are minimums that are recommended, not maximums. And if you eat more fiber than that, I'm sure many days I'll double that because I like legumes. I like a big bowl of lentils. And, you know, for supper I might have another legume or something and lots of fresh fruits and vegetables through the day and whole grains. And so there's nothing wrong with eating more. What you wouldn't want to do is just take fiber by itself and like put it in a cup with water or something and drink huge amounts of it, that wouldn't be good. But eat it in the foods, the healthy foods.
In the Caribbean, we have foods like green banana.
Green banana.
Yeah.
Bananas are fine. And the green bananas, you probably would fry them or something.
Boil them.
Okay. They would be a starchy food, and so I think I'd have to look them up to see what their glycemic index is. I'm just remembering bananas are about 85 or something. So not too bad. But you probably wouldn't want to eat all of those. You might want some other good whole grains and other kinds of things as well. Uh-huh. He's asking about the ratio of different kinds of foods. I'm not sure I'm picking up on it, but
they have high carb diets, right? Where they
uh-huh.
Just high carb diets.
what percentage of the calories should come from carbohydrate, for example?
Yes.
Here's what you'll find. He's asking what percentage of our calories should come from carbohydrates. First thing we need to do is we need to make sure they're unrefined. Secondly, we need to kind of have them in balance, don't we? There's three things that the body needs for a good balanced diet. We need good healthy proteins, good healthy fats, and good carbohydrates. Now, what if we push the carbohydrates heavily and they get way up there as percentage of calories? What will happen? Well, two things will happen. One is you will have a higher blood sugar level simply because there's so many carbohydrates. And number two, you will suppress HDL levels. And that increases our risk for coronary heart disease. So rather than getting too much carbohydrates, we need enough, but let's also get some healthy proteins and some healthy fats so it's balanced. Then your HDL levels will be better. The healthy fats and proteins both keep the HDL levels up, and they keep the blood glucose levels down. So I think you can eat too many carbohydrates. And what we'll find in the Adventist church is we push carbohydrates all the time. And we don't say much at all about proteins. I don't know why. And then we're kind of hard on the fats. And so people end up eating a lot of carbohydrates. So it's better to balance it out, have a healthy carbohydrate, a healthy fat, a healthy protein at every meal. And that's more balanced. I think the health of most Adventist diets, vegetarians, would be healthier if they perhaps ate a fewer carbohydrates and maybe a little more of the healthy proteins and the healthy carbohydrates with it. I mean, the healthy fats. Balance it a little better. Just my observation.
One of your early slides mentioned glycemic load versus glycemic index.
Uh-huh. What is glycemic? You can kind of think of them the same way. What the glycemic load is they take the amount of carbohydrate in grams, multiply that times the glycemic index. And because you see, if you eat one bite of a potato, or if you eat a whole giant potato, see, there's a lot of difference, isn't there? And the glycemic index would be the same, but the glycemic load takes in how much carbohydrate you eat with it. And so that's when they looked at heart disease, they looked at glycemic load. All right. Well, let's move along here quickly, and we'll bring up the next one. Figure out how to do this here. Does that make good sense to us?
Good.
Okay. Now, let's move on to the next one, which happens to be healthy proteins. If I can get it going. There it goes. Okay, protein is important too, isn't it? In fact, it's required for building strong muscles, bones, organs, a healthy immune system. It all requires adequate protein. People don't think of their bones as having much protein in, but they're about half protein. And research shows that a lot of times, especially in older age, if you're not getting enough protein and you add a little more protein to your diet, you'll actually have healthier bones and lower fraction rates. Certainly good for our immune system, isn't it? So we need adequate amounts. Our proteins should all be, again, unrefined foods, shouldn't they? That contribute to protein. And it says not all foods high in protein are necessarily good for you. Because sometimes people say, well, it's high in protein, must be good. Well, a hamburger with cheese all melted over the top. High in protein, isn't it? But what else does it have? Well, a lot of fat and cholesterol. So we have to evaluate what is associated with it. So, and then the other corollary that goes with that is you need enough protein, but more is not necessarily better. Some type of people say, well, if it's good for you, eat twice as much. Well, we've got that problem in the United States. We've been eating twice as much too long, haven't we? So we need enough, but more than that is not necessarily bad for you or harmful to you and not necessarily desirable. Okay. Now, protein foods that are foods that are rich in protein, or healthy proteins, which we're going to define it, are foods that are rich in protein and contain at least 8 to 10 grams of protein per serving. They're unrefined, not highly processed. They're not high in saturated fat or cholesterol or sodium. Sometimes I'm worried about this one in some of our meat alternates. They're pretty high in sodium. And they contribute other key nutrients as well, including fiber, antioxidants, vitamins, minerals, and so on. So So a good example of that would be beans. Legumes are high in protein, they're high in fiber, they're high in antioxidants. They're almost as high as some of the things we think about, like blueberries and so on, when you look at the antioxidant levels. Very good that way. And they're low in saturated fat, and they're cholesterol-free. So those meets all the criteria, doesn't it? And so legumes are very healthy protein, and we find that they're protective. Again, studies show they're protective against heart disease and cancer, and the Adventist Health Study showed that. Other studies show that they're helpful in preventing diabetes, so there's a good one. So here's some other examples. We can look down through the list there and see those. We've mentioned the legumes, the soy. Soy happens to be the highest in protein of any plant-based food, and a very healthy kind of a protein. Then there's the things like the meat alternates, the garden burgers and vegetarian entrees and things. Nuts and nut butters are all good, healthy proteins. And if you're going to be using dairy, using the non-fat dairy would be a healthier kind. You get most of the cholesterol and the saturated fat out, so the skim milk or a low-fat yogurt or a low-fat cottage cheese could be a good source of protein. If you use eggs, don't use too many. American Heart Association says what? No more than 3 to 4 per week. All right. Or some people will use egg beaters in their place so they don't get rid of the cholesterol, but they still have the same amount of protein. And do we have anybody in our church that eats meat? Yeah, over half. So that's why I'm including these. And if you're going to be using meat, what are the healthiest kinds? Well, skinless poultry has most all of the fat removed. What's left is mostly protein. That'd be a little healthier. And fish, what's the story on fish? Does fish have a lot of saturated fat? No. It doesn't. It's a healthy fat. Has some cholesterol, the same amount of cholesterol as meat, but the kind of fat, which is the most important thing, controlling our own, is better. So people who eat more fish, what's the result of that? They actually have fewer heart attacks. They have less risk of Alzheimer's disease. So if you have people in your church that are eating meat regularly, what would be the healthier kinds? Yeah, they'd be the healthier kinds. And then hopefully over time they could see that there are other sources too, plant-based sources, that are even healthier, have other advantage. But anyway, this would meet everybody's needs. Yes? Most any fish, but the cold water fishes are the ones that have the highest polyunsaturated fats and also the highest level of the N3 fatty acids. But I think most fish would fall in that category. Okay. If you'll read the internet, there's a lot of things circulating on the internet that says soy is bad for you. Have you read some of that? But if you will read the scientific journals, you don't find that. It's just in the popular press. You'll find practically no studies or any health organization that says soy is damaging for you. In fact, the U.S. government has made a statement that they put on things where you eat soy, that if you eat a certain amount of soy per day, it will reduce your risk of heart disease. So it's not based on evidence-based research. It's some theories that people have had, and they write a lot about it, but we don't have any evidence that it's harmful. We've had several good studies in the last couple of years that show that people who eat more soy actually live longer, and they don't have as much disease. One of the things that women particularly were concerned about was soy and breast cancer. Have you heard that one? And a good definitive study came out on that recently where they did several thousand people. They looked at their diets very closely. These were all women who had already had breast cancer, and they're a high risk of developing cancer again, wouldn't they be? So they said, let's look at their diets. Let's see what we can do, what kinds of things would be predictive whether they get breast cancer again or not. They followed them for several years, saw those who got breast cancer and those who didn't. And what they found, that one of the most protective foods against redeveloping breast cancer was soy. I have it. Don't have it right here because we're kind of as a question more than what I've prepared for. But yes, and if you get my newsletter, we put that kind of thing out regularly, an email newsletter, and you're welcome to get that. It will bring these studies up regularly. So what we're finding is that all the current research is showing that it's safe. In fact, in that particular study, they looked at those women who were taking tamoxifen. Are you familiar with that? That's a substance that people take for what? Helping, they think it might be helpful, and there's good research to show that it is, in reducing the risk of breast cancer. In this particular study, they found that soy was even more protective than the tamoxifen in preventing breast cancer. So again, if you look at evidence-based research, soy is not a problem. By the way, which country in the world lives the longest? Which group of people? Japanese. Japanese have the best longevity of any people in the world. And what do you suppose? They eat a lot more soy than we ever do. So it's not a problem. A comment in the back? No problem. If you eat the soybean. Now, there were some early studies that kind of began to raise eyebrows earlier in life, that if you had large amounts of isolated isoflavones that they took out of the soybean, concentrated them, so they had very high levels of this, they were afraid that it might have estrogen-like effects and might affect children. Actually, we don't have any research to show that it's a problem yet, but we don't recommend you take the isoflavones out and take them in large quantities. But if you eat the whole soy food, tofu, soybeans, those kinds of things, there's no problem whatsoever. And what we actually find out is the kind of estrogen that's in the soybean, called a phytoestrogen, has very little effects on what regular estrogen would do, and actually lowers the risk rather than raising it. What happens is you have estrogen receptors in certain parts of the body, and the phytoestrogen attaches to those estrogen receptors, and they block other estrogen from, you see, being targeting those organs, so they actually decrease the risk of estrogen, which can be, if it's high in the diet, be a factor that raises risk for cancer. So it actually protects against that. All right, unhealthy proteins. Recognize a couple of them there? a good American breakfast, would you say? If you like eating breakfast at Denny's and some of those kinds of things, that's their specialty. Unhealthy proteins are foods that are high in saturated fat, cholesterol, and calories. Okay, three things we need to be careful of. And if we get too much, they cause problems. And if we look at red meat and hamburgers and hot dogs and luncheon meats, very high risk for those things. Tacos, very high in the saturated fats. Pizzas loaded with cheese, pepperoni, very high in saturated fat. And that, by the way, happens to be the primary source of saturated fat in the American diet. If you look at all the foods that people eat, pizzas with cheese and pepperonis, that's the highest source of saturated fat in the American diet. Fried chicken is very high. Most people don't realize that. You get just as much saturated fat in a fried chicken as you, if you go to Colonel Sanders or one of those, as you would in a beef, in a hamburger. And then, of course, fried eggs and bacon can add a lot of extra fat, too. So what happens when we eat too many of those kinds of unhealthy fats? And here we have a study on meat intake. This is red meat, beef and pork primarily. Could be lamb or something as well. And they simply took a large group of people, and how many in this study? Does it say? Doesn't say on that slide. Missed it. It's 500,000 people. One of the largest studies that's ever been done in the United States. They took 500,000 people, and here again we see these quintiles. That's the 20%. So on the left is those who have the lowest meat intake, and every time there's an increase in the amount of red meat in the diet, what happens to the risk of dying from any cause? It increases, doesn't it? So if you're the researcher, and you study 500,000 people and follow them for 10 years, and you see that every time there's a small increase in the amount of red meat they eat per day, they're more likely to die, what would you recommend? Don't eat red meat. And so now the American Cancer Society and the American Heart Association and all these other organizations are saying, first rule number one, eat more of a plant-based foods and plant-based proteins and eat less red meat. They're not willing to say entirely, don't eat it at all. But that's the message, isn't it? Eat less and less of it, and as we eat more and more healthy things, pretty soon we don't need that at all. So here's just a little exercise. How much protein do you need? Well, about 12 to 15% of your calories. And that's about, if you want to figure that out for yourself, you multiply your weight times 0.4. And if you need a little more protein, if you're on a weight control program or building big muscles from weightlifting or something, multiply it by 0.5. And you can see that's been done there for you. So it's not a lot, isn't it? About 58 grams, maybe for an average woman, and about 72 for an average man. Now, once you meet those needs, you've got good health, and there's no added advantage to eat more, but also it says there's not a disadvantage, or it's not harmful if you eat a little more. So you don't have to worry about a high-protein diet damaging your health. And here we can just look at some quick examples, and we won't spend much time on there, but you can go down and see. Some of those foods are pretty rich, aren't they? Cottage cheese is pretty high in protein. Look at beans, 15 grams per cup. Or soybeans, 28 grams. And remember, that's not only the highest in quantity, it's also the highest in quality of protein. And we put meat down at the bottom as a comparison. 2 ounces of most of those would give about 14 grams. They're high in protein, but they also have, some of them, some disadvantages, don't they? But even the whole grains, oatmeal, vegetables, they all contribute some, don't they, if they're unrefined. And even berries, fruits, have a little bit. So here's a sample breakfast. Might be what someone might eat for breakfast. They start out with some oatmeal. I prefer to use soy milk as opposed to cow's milk, so I'd put a soy milk on mine, and it has about the same amount of protein, by the way. Both have 9 grams, and a little peanut butter on your whole wheat bread, and what do you already have? 25 grams of protein, see? So it's not difficult, is it? Or a sample lunch. You might start out with a veggie burger. Do you like the garden burgers? I've liked those when they came out, and I work with mostly non-Adventists, and we would go out to eat together, and they say, well, what are you having? I'd say, well, I'm going to have a garden burger today. And they say, well, what is that? I say, well, why don't you try it? You might like it. And they'd get done eating that on a nice whole wheat bun, and they'd say, hey, that's not so bad, is it? And I said, yeah, it's cholesterol-free and low in saturated fat. It can be something you might like to try. So some of the things are pretty easy. And then a bowl of lentil soup with that, and a little apple for dessert, maybe a little handful of mixed nuts. And for lunch, you could have as much as 37 grams. So if you eat unrefined foods, choose some healthy proteins. It's not difficult, is it? And here's something for dinner. Maybe you have an oat, soy oat roast or a Swiss steak or something like that, a bowl of vegetable chili, some green peas, some brown rice for the grain, and maybe some walnuts in the salad, and maybe a little glass of red grape juice for dessert or kind of for fun. That's what I do instead of wine. And then maybe an oatmeal cookie for dessert, and there's another 29 grams. See how that adds up? So for the whole day, you're already up well over what's needed, isn't it? 91 grams a day. So every meal, try to plan a healthy protein. Protein does have the advantage of being very low glycemic index, and it keeps your blood sugar levels up. It has a long satiety value. It's absorbed slowly, and you don't get so hungry afterwards. So having a little protein with your meal is helpful. Have you ever gone out to a Chinese restaurant where they just had chopped vegetables and white rice, and you eat it, and what happens 2 hours later? You're starved again already, aren't you? See, it's all carbohydrate. So make sure you throw some tofu in with it. Or I tell them, put some cashews on top. Something that's got some healthy fats and proteins with it. And then we don't get so hungry. It lasts us a little longer, and it also helps give us a little more balanced diet. So plan for a healthy protein food, rich food in every meal. Eat a wide variety of whole plant-based foods in sufficient quantities to maintain your weight, and you'll automatically get adequate protein, even if you have no animal products in your diet at all. And limit the refined foods. Not much protein is there in sugar, margarine, soft drink, zero. So be careful of those foods. Okay, does that make good sense on protein? Any questions? 12:30, time to eat. Good.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com or If you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.